Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'll be speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is June 30th, 2011. Thank you to all our listeners. We are having a special show today on vaccinations and your rights in the United States, and that it's a call-in show if anyone is listening, and we're answering the most commonly asked questions, those questions that Alan has recently received. And if you're new to Blog Talk Radio, we would like you to get onto the chat by going to the Blog Talk Radio website, and there is a little conversation section window that you can log on to and post your questions right there. Also, we have other shows during the week. On Monday, we're studying the Organon of Medicine. Wednesdays, show about organic gardening is on hold, and we'll be doing special presentations, having special guests coming on in the future during the Wednesday slot. And on Sunday evening, we have a short one-half-hour meditation session. And I would like to introduce our co-host, Alan Phillips, who is an attorney at law in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys. He advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. He has also published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters and appears regularly at rallies, conferences on the radio and television. He is a regular guest on Freedomizer Radio and Liberty News Radio as well. And the last part we're going to tell you, he's on a lot of advisory boards. The American Chiropractic Autism Board, a board member of the World Association for Vaccine Education, and a co-founder of the North Carolina Citizens for Healthcare Freedom. I had the pleasure of meeting in person this week, and I would like to get started on today's show. So, Alan, I think you can hear me.
I can, and you, me as well, I hope.
Okay, put up your sound just a little drop, and we'll be good.
Let me see. I may just have to talk louder or switch here. I'm using a headset.
Or talk into your mic. Do you have a mic? Are you using a headset?
Yes.
Okay. There should be a little clicker on your mic that you can just put the sound up or down. Or maybe it's just I can just put my sound up a little bit. But so what we're going to do today is something a little bit different from our typical show. We usually talk about headlines in the news and legislative actions and white papers that you have presented. So today's show is more about questions and answers of typical things or maybe an unusual question that you've heard in the past.
Well, I discovered quickly when I first started working in the vaccine exemption and waiver arena that there are many, many different aspects and facets to the topic legally and factually. And this led to my both receiving and exploring a variety of questions. Ultimately, in the practice of law, every client's situation is unique. And I have heard attorneys who are 30-year veterans of law say they see new things come in the door all the time that they've never seen before. So it's impossible to put together a single list of questions and answers that'll cover everything that's going to come up. But I did see, as is typical probably in most areas of law, a series of questions that and kinds of questions that I tend to get repeatedly. So I think it is legitimate in this arena to refer to, as is commonly referred to on many websites, FAQs or frequently asked questions. And in fact, I have a section on my vaccinerights.com website where I have some of those questions. So I thought today we would open up the floor for listeners to present whatever questions they have, and we'll look at some of those, or we'll look at questions that are just some of the common ones that come up, even if no one today is asking them. For example,
it's good to kind of open the gate. Start it off by giving the kinds of questions, and then they can probably think of other questions off of that. That's good.
Absolutely. So, for example, one really common question is people say, can you exercise a vaccine exemption? Or they'll often ask specifically a religious exemption in particular if you've had vaccines in the past. And I'll say as a preface to this and other questions, I have found in this arena that there is both a widespread lack of understanding about the details and the boundaries of rights of vaccine exemptions, as well as a fairly widespread set of beliefs that are common misunderstandings or misbeliefs about vaccine exemptions. So, for example, it's quite common that I've even run into people who didn't even know there were exemptions to vaccines, didn't know there was any way that you could refuse vaccines, and people who are aware of religious exemptions not uncommonly but mistakenly think you have to be a Christian Scientist or a member of some religion that has tenets opposed to immunizations.
Can I kind of redirect the answer just a moment? But you're giving a lot of background to that. But it sounds like specifically you're asking if a person or people in their family have had vaccinations in the past, can they now switch and say, I have a different philosophy, a different belief, have been educated in a different way, and get change from what their behavior was and practice was in the past to a new set of behaviors? I think that's Is that what you're getting at?
Sort of veering away from that, so thanks for reeling me back in. And let me just focus more directly in on that question. The short answer is it doesn't matter if you've had past vaccines.
Okay.
For purposes of a medical exemption, if you have the qualifying medical condition, it doesn't matter whether you've had past vaccines or not. But the same is true of religious exemptions. This is one of the examples where the law is consistent with probably what most people would consider a common sense point of view once I explain it. Many times law does that, but not always. Unfortunately, this is one where it does. And what the law says, what the federal legal precedent tells us, is that what matters is that you have right now, as you are making the assertion, as you're claiming the exemption, that you have, for purposes of religious exemptions, that you have a belief that is religious in nature and that is sincerely held. And the reason I think this fits common sense is because we all know that people can and do have changes in their religious beliefs. People can convert from one religion to another or can have
They can change churches every week, it seems to, I'm just being exaggerating, but people do, as people grow and develop and learn and become different, hopefully become better people every day, they could easily change how they feel about a specific issue in their life.
Yeah, so as a matter of legal technicality, you could change your religion, your beliefs might have changed yesterday, and today you could exercise a religious exemption that you couldn't have exercised yesterday. As a practical matter, though, it may be hard to convince someone that your beliefs are sincerely held if you had vaccines in the last few weeks or months, and you're claiming a religious exemption to vaccines now. But can you do that as a technical legal matter? Absolutely. And I have many clients who themselves or their children have had vaccines in the past. What the legal precedent also says is that it's not for the courts to judge whether or not someone has been faithful fully to their beliefs. In other words, you may have gotten vaccines in the past over your religious objections or contrary to your religious objections. You were coerced into it, pressured into it, or you feared harm from the diseases. And bottom line, just because you were unfaithful to your beliefs, let's say your religious beliefs were always against vaccines, but you vaccinated in the past. The federal courts tell us it's not up to the courts to decide whether or not you're faithful or to hold you to being unfaithful now just because you were unfaithful to your beliefs in the past. Again, all that matters is that right now, as you're exercising or declaring the exemption, that you have a sincerely held religious belief that's opposed to vaccines, and then you meet the legal requirements.
And would you say that a person who does this and is in a situation of being pressured to take a vaccination, do they need legal counsel to support them in any way? Because it seems like they might be on shaky grounds stating this on their own without having any background in law or constitution or anything like that.
Well, in the question, if I may paraphrase or rephrase, when do you need an attorney, is really an important question because there's two or more different aspects to this. As far as when would I recommend somebody involve an attorney, there are, in a general sense, two or three different sorts of situations where I would say yes. If it's a situation where there's either any current conflict or an impending conflict, then that's a good time to consider involving an attorney so that you can kind of nip that in the bud if at all possible. But one of the problems with this area, and it's true of other areas of law as well, is that there are a lot of there are people who make unintended mistakes because of what I refer to as the what you don't know that you don't know syndrome. That is, there are ways that you can undermine your exemption right unintentionally, and that very reasonable, intelligent people can do that without realizing that they're doing it because of what they don't understand about how the law works. And this is where I am as delicately as possible or sensitively as possible critical of some of the anti-vaccine websites when most of them, in my experience, their information, when they start talking about exemption rights and procedures, they end up usually with a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information. It's not because they're uninformed in a general sense, or certainly not because they're lacking any intelligence, and I mean absolutely no disrespect. These folks are all my peers in raising awareness about vaccine issues. We're all on the same team. But there are things that you wouldn't know to think, to ask, or to do or not do unless you were knowledgeable about the law in this area, and it is multifaceted, the legal analysis, especially with religious exemptions. There are multiple components, and there are over a dozen different areas where the question comes up, how do I legally avoid vaccines? And so it can quickly get complicated.
Yeah, it seems like when you go to court, for no matter whether it's a traffic violation or whatever it might be, it's wise to have legal counsel. And when you're, if you're taken in for a court case or something, or whatever is going on, they usually advise you to get counsel, or the state will provide counsel. And then there's so many complicated issues dealing with exemption in each state, it may vary, and you might not know specifically what are the guidelines, what are the precedents and the rules and laws in that state, that it is sounds like you really should have someone who's more knowledgeable.
Well, of these dozen or so different areas or contexts, and perhaps I'll run a quick list in a minute to clarify what I mean by that, there can be different law that applies in each of these situations, and that's part of the inherent complexity. But let me simplify this a little bit by explaining situations where you don't need to have an attorney.
Okay.
In terms of school exemptions, let's say, for children in grade school, in many states, there is a state form where you check a box or you sign the form, and that's a real simple, straightforward process. Or exercising philosophical exemptions, often you write a very short statement just saying you object on philosophical grounds or personal beliefs. Even some states, school exemption laws where they don't have a form, but the statement you write, they're not asking you to explain what your beliefs are. They're just asking you to state that your beliefs, your religious beliefs, are opposed to immunizations. And sometimes they require it to be notarized and some don't. You really have to look at each state individually, because each state has its own laws for school exemptions and their own procedure, specific procedure for how to do that. But if you don't have to do anything more than write a very short statement or check a box or sign a form, you probably don't need to involve an attorney unless you've got some sort of conflict or impending conflict. But if you're in a state or other context, federal context, where you have to state what your religious beliefs are, there are some very specific pitfalls there to avoid, and that's a time when it's good to involve an attorney. Now, here's why. Unfortunately, how to write those statements of belief does not boil down to a formulaic process. There's no formula for here's how you do it or here's what you say. And the reason is that there is federal precedent that can be used against you if you copy something that somebody else said. That is, if you're copying from an anti-vaccine website or somewhere else, and if you copy something off the internet in particular, it takes only a few seconds for somebody to take a phrase from your statement, plug it into a search engine, and pull up the web page or web pages that have your statement. And there are a lot of sample letters and statements that have been passed around the internet and are posted on multiple sites. So it's real easy for someone on the other side to find out if you copied something that's posted on the internet, and there's legal precedent that tells them they get to reject your exemption if it's copied. The rationale is that if it's copied, it must not be sincere, and which is really ironic. I had clients myself a couple of years ago who knew that they didn't know anything about the law and got a statement from someone else, from some other source outside of themselves, and they were very sincere. They were so sincere, and they had a letter that originally came from an attorney, as a matter of fact. And they were so concerned about doing this the right way, they were so sincere that they used a letter from an attorney, and it ended up being used against them. So here's my point with that story. You may be absolutely sincere when you copy something, but the act of copying legally can be rejected for the fact of it being copied, whether you did it because you were sincere or not. It can
right,
be rejected
well,
as being insincere. So
it sounds very much as if you're taking a school exam or handing in a paper, and there are websites that check whether students are plagiarizing, whether they're copying something that's been done elsewhere. And in actuality, I mean, perhaps people do use that technique because they don't know how to put it into their own words. But if the court or whoever, the governing body, is using that as a means to reject someone, somebody's going to have it. How many stories can there be? And of course, they can be as unique as possible about situations, but a lot of them are going to be very similar. So it's good to know that they have to personalize it in some way, to maybe put facts, dates, places, names of people, or something that makes it their very own.
Right. And when I work with clients to develop these, what I refer to as statements of religious beliefs or statements of beliefs, it's usually a back and forth process. There are some very specific guidelines that I've developed over the years from a combination of studying the federal legal precedent in particular and some state precedent, and just seeing over time what works and what doesn't work. And I don't publish those, though, because when I work with clients, it's a back-and-forth process. I'll give them information and materials to help them get started or to the extent they need that. But then we go back and forth, and they, of course, are always scrutinizing to make sure what they have written and any way that it gets modified based on my input, that it, at the end it represents their true beliefs. And then, of course, I'm scrutinizing from my point of view to make sure that it is legally as strong as it can be. And I want to underscore what I mean by that, that. But we often are looking at the strength of a statement. It's not an a black and white. This is a good statement. This is a bad statement. Although certainly you can characterize statements in those terms, but because each statement is unique and it doesn't, ideally each statement is unique, each person or family's statement. Therefore, it doesn't reduce to a formula, and you can't just say definitively or absolutely, yes, you have it, or no, you don't. But there are very specific guidelines that I use to help clients put these together. It's to maximize the strength of the statement. And by that, I mean minimize the likelihood that it's going to be contested, and at the same time, maximizing the likelihood that if it is contested, if it is rejected, that you can defend it and say this was improperly rejected because it meets all the legal requirements. And so that's bottom line what we're looking for there. But,
so when people call you for assistance to create their statement that will be written in the strongest legal possible way, it's really honing how they really feel. I mean, it's seems like what you're doing, it's almost like coaching, getting them to get in touch with their own religious or philosophical beliefs to make it the most clear and clarify how they feel to and make it really personal at the same time. So it's really it's something that's in development when they speak with you.
Yeah, it my clients collectively fall within a range with regard to that. Some of them are very clear what their religious beliefs and objections are, and they just need some coaching in how to present that in the most effective way possible. Other clients are real clear that it's a religious matter for them and that they object, but they're not as clear for any of a number of possible reasons, not as well able to articulate specifically the beliefs. And so a client in that situation, we start then, well, what are the concepts? What are the ideas that you're dealing with? And I'll help them put it in their own words. I don't ever tell a client what to say or what their beliefs are. I mean, that would be probably unethical in terms of attorney ethical rules, for one thing, but would be disingenuous. You know, I did have a client on one occasion say, I don't care what you say, just put down something that'll work. Well, I could probably do that at this point pretty darn well. But
I hope I didn't imply that that's something that you do. Not at all.
Okay. I just want to clarify for listeners that, you know, getting an attorney is not about, it's not as simple as, oh, write something for me that will work, as maybe you would do in other situations, but when you're talking about asserting beliefs, it really needs to come from the client for both ethical and practical reasons. It really needs to be unique to the client. It needs to be in their words and their thoughts and their ideas, but there are absolutely, there are some very clear do's and don'ts, and then there are some less clear general guidelines that I have found over time to be very effective, very successful.
Okay, well, why don't we move on to the next little kind of sub-question. It's a lot of people ask that if they don't attend a church or never have attended some sort of an organized religious setting, do they need to pick a religion to claim as their own for the purpose of religious exemption?
Yeah, and there are several parts to this question. It's a very good one, and again, one of the more frequent ones or variations of it. There are people who have joined churches in order to be able to say, I have a religious objection. They'll join a church that has religious tenets opposed to immunizations. Most laws today that concern vaccine requirements do not require membership in an organized religion. If you're in a state that has a law like that, or a territory, I think maybe Puerto Rico still has a law, something like that, there's a difficulty there if you don't belong to one of those kind of churches, because there's federal legal precedent that says it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion, that you have First Amendment protection, the part of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that refers to the free exercise of religion, called the Free Exercise Clause. You have federal First Amendment protection of your beliefs so long as they are religious in nature and sincere, whether or not they're connected with any particular organized religion, and regardless of what religion you belong to, if you do. In other words, you can be Catholic or Protestant or Methodist or Buddhist or Taoist. And I've seen pretty much every major religion of the world at one time or another, and many different variations of denominational and non-denominational Christianity, as well as people who have no organized church affiliation whatsoever, and all of them can potentially qualify for a religious exemption. But there are some pitfalls here. There's a federal court case where a chiropractor joined a religion in order to get the exemption. That came out in the evidence in the testimony at trial, and the court didn't have any concern about whether it was religious. It was a church, but since he had joined to get the exemption, it was considered insincere.
How would they know that he joined for that specific reason alone?
Well, it had to have come out in the evidence at trial somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, the court would not have that as a factor to consider in its ruling. So, and that raises a very practical question, because sometimes when people say, "Hey, can I join a church to get the exemption?" and a practical answer to that would be, "Yes, so long as you get away with it." You know, you can do anything you want to in this world. The question is whether you're going to get caught or not. You know, the vast majority of crimes committed are never solved. And so there are people who, get away with murder and other lesser crimes. And
okay,
that doesn't make it legal. And so what we're talking about here on a practical matter is, what increases or decreases your chances of success or your risk of having your exemption rejected. So in practical terms, it's best to avoid joining a church just for the purpose of getting the exemption, because if that later comes out, then that can be held against you and be a basis for rejecting the exemption. Of course, if it never comes out, it might work fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to be particularly careful of mail-order churches, as they're sometimes called, churches that are really set up not as a really genuine, legitimate church in the sense that we typically think of it. There was part of the criticism of the court in this case where the chiropractor joined a church, or it may be a different case that I'm thinking of now. But in any case, there was a federal court case where the court noted that the church that the person had joined was something that he joined through the mail, that was not a church that actually had any regular meetings or any congregation. All you had to do was pay some money and you could be a minister and things like that. Those kinds of things I think you really need to stay away from. The validity or legitimacy of those kinds of organizations may vary from state to state.
Mm-hmm.
I believe North Carolina has had some a statutory or case law referring to, not in the religious exemption to vaccines context, but nonetheless, referring to the validity or lack of validity of some of these kinds of churches where they're not really
right.
functioning as a church in the more stereotypical sense. Now, that doesn't mean a church has to be an Orthodox religion or a conventional religion, but if you call yourself a church and you don't do the things that churches generally do in every religion, regular meetings, have a congregation, have, you know, some document about what your religion is about and so forth. If you don't have sort of the common things that most religions have, you run the risk of not being considered legitimate for legal purposes.
I see. That's kind of complicated. I could imagine that there are certain churches that I've known where people, there are spiritual entities which are more like schools where they teach, where a person can get a ministerial degree, but they are not per se the typical go to this facility, and it's more an online school ministry.
I don't think that in and of itself would invalidate it. If you have regular activities, educational activities or whatever, I think you would be fine with that. It's the ones that have been set up where really they're just saying somebody just got the mm-hmm. great idea that they could legally set up a quote-unquote church in their state by doing whatever the state requires, if anything,
right.
to declare themselves a church, and then charge people to hand out a ministerial credential. Oh, send me $25 and you can
right.
be this level minister. Send me $100, you get to be this level. And
right.
without, you know, really more of a scam than a church. And I think
right.
that's the kind of thing you got to look at. Is it really a sincere religious or spiritual endeavor, or is it just sort of a scam? And if somebody sets up a church for the, and people have done this in the past, set up a church for the purpose of giving people who want
the paper
to avoid
on the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
for to avoid vaccines specifically. And if that's the reason the church is founded, you probably shouldn't join it. But most of the time, you don't need to affiliate with an organized religion anyway. So if you're in a rare situation where the law still says that, there may be ways you can deal with that, but it's a little more complicated.
Okay, well, I have two questions. One is a follow-up on what you're just talking about, which is, you said, certain regions of the country, such as Puerto Rico, may require a membership in an organized religion. Thus, if someone contested that based on their constitutional rights, that would have to go up to maybe the Supreme Court, I don't know where, to change that?
Well, let me see if I can elaborate on this, because it gets a little more complicated, and there are several parts and pieces to this. First of all, as I've mentioned probably repeatedly on this show in the past, because it's such an important point, there's federal legal precedent that says it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion or which one you belong to. If you do, as long as you have beliefs that are sincerely held and religious in nature, you can refuse vaccines. The problem then, or question and problem both, that arises is when and where is that legal precedent applicable? And that legal precedent comes out of federal district courts, primarily federal district courts, and maybe one case that's the Second Circuit, which is a federal court with over three states up in New England, New York, and a couple of other states. And precedent is only binding on the jurisdiction that it comes out of. So a lot of the legal precedent for vaccine religious exemptions comes out of New York. It's not binding on any of the rest of the country. It is what's called persuasive precedent for the rest of the country. So courts in California don't have to follow the New York precedent, but they can look at the New York precedent, especially if they don't have any precedent in their own jurisdictions. And the practical reality is that states around the country have been following the precedent coming out of those New York federal district courts, but they don't have to. So what this means as a legal technicality is this. I believe Puerto Rico, last time I checked, had a religious exemption law that required membership in an organized religion. But let's assume, even if that's wrong, let's assume it just for the sake of conversation here for the moment. the legal precedent coming out of New York is not binding on actually, Puerto Rico may be a bad example because it's a territory. Let's pick a state. Let's say we have a state that, because the application of the precedent might be different in a territory than in a state, and I'm not entirely even clear on that myself. So let's talk about a state, because a territory is a federal jurisdiction, not a separate state jurisdiction. So let's say Iowa or some state, you know, has a law, and I know there are at least a couple, one or two states, if not more, that still have that kind of law on the books, whether or not it's even enforced anymore. If it's outside of New York, the jurisdiction where this federal precedent I keep referring to comes from, the courts in Iowa don't have to follow that. And so if Iowa has a state law that says you have to be a member of an organized religion, then that law is still quote-unquote good law. It's still enforceable, even though there's federal precedent somewhere else, and even though federal law is a higher authority legally than state law. And usually if there's a conflict between state and federal law, then the federal law supersedes the state law. The problem is that if the federal law comes from another jurisdiction, then technically there's not a conflict, okay? So, but what has happened as a practical matter, in at least five different states, these kinds of law have been challenged in court, and every time they've been held to be unconstitutional. So the overwhelming likelihood is that if somebody challenged such a state law in Iowa or whatever state may still have one, odds are they would win. But unless and until it is challenged and held to be unconstitutional, then technically it is still constitutional in that state. In fact, this is one of my great frustrations with regard to vaccine legislative issues, as I probably have mentioned on this show in the past as well, that the bottom line, states can pass laws, state legislatures can pass laws, even if they are technically unconstitutional. Maybe that's the wrong way to phrase it. Even if they are unconstitutional, because technically a law isn't unconstitutional unless and until it's challenged by a court and the court decides it's unconstitutional. If it were any other way, anybody could just say at any time, oh, that law is unconstitutional, and no laws would ever be valid anywhere, because anybody could say that anytime they want to. So it's not formally technically unconstitutional unless a court rules that to be the case. So there are still some state laws, bottom line, that require membership in an organized religion, and perhaps Puerto Rico and other territories. And those laws may be perfectly valid and good laws unless and until they are challenged. Having mm-hmm. said that, I know of at least one instance, Oregon used to have one of those kind of laws. And somebody, I heard a story about somebody who found an attorney in Oregon who just really aggressively argued in favor of their client, and probably because of this legal precedent from other jurisdictions. And the local school system eventually backed down and said, okay, she doesn't have to be a member of organized religion, even though the law says that. When something like that happens, it's not because the client has a clear legal right. It's because the school system realizes that if it goes to court, they're going to lose, and they just don't want to take the time and money and energy to do that.
Mm-hmm. Make it financially stressful to have to go through that process. We you're not on the chat today, but there is a little tiny conversation going on there from Dr. Bob and Victor, who say, you know, he says, why do I have to have beliefs? I think that vaccinations can harm me. Why should I be questioned about this? But who decides if my religion is valid? I mean, he's giving us, you know, there is the flying spaghetti. The flying spaghetti monster is people believe in that religious group. And who has the right to question him, you know, an individual, I guess he's asking. And to go even further than that, Dr. Bob is saying that when you question, you're violating his First Amendment rights if he has a religious belief. Then Victor is saying...
Well, hang on a second, because you've already asked about five questions, and do you want to take those one at a time and look at them?
Should we save it for another show?
Well, no, those are all really good questions. Let's pick that apart, though, and talk about each piece, because those are all very important and very good pieces and questions. So let me start with the first one, or one of the first pieces there, because it's the same question as one of the questions that is addressed on my vaccinerights.com Q&A, where somebody says, don't I have the right to refuse vaccines based on studies and research that shows that vaccines cause reactions? And certainly on a common sense level, it makes no sense whatsoever to me that we would not have that right. The fact is that we don't. And the fact, and I'll explain that in a minute, and the fact that we don't is something that should give anyone great concern, regardless of what their views are on vaccines, but certainly especially those who have studied this subject and believe there are some serious problems, because there is substantial, credible evidence to suggest that there are problems and that we really do not even know the scope of the problems. That fact alone, that we don't know the scope and severity of adverse events with any accuracy whatsoever, that fact alone is basis enough that everybody should have the right to decide for themselves rather than our government deciding for us. But in our so-called democratic society, our government, at least in theory, does reflect the will of the people. We could have a whole separate conversation for hours on end about democracy and does it work and what kind of democracy do we have and so forth. But the practical reality is that our government is empowered under our federal and state constitutions to enact laws requiring immunizations. And the fact of the enactment of an immunization requirement, a law requiring immunizations, carries with it a legal presumption that vaccines are reasonably safe and effective. That is, I'm not saying I agree with that personally, but legally, presumably the legislature considered both or all sides of the issue when they were considering whether or not to enact the vaccine mandates in the first place. And our legislature, state legislators and federal legislature with regard to the federal context and the federal agencies that determine for immigrants in the military, et cetera, requirements there, in their infinite wisdom, looked at the issue of vaccines and decided that they were safe and effective enough to be mandated. And that carries, so again, the fact of the enactment carries with it a legal presumption that vaccines are reasonably safe and effective. Now, if we disagree with that, it's our task as citizens to take the information that we have and go back and educate our state and federal legislatures and the federal agencies and get them to change the requirements, change the laws, change the regulations. Now, you know, that's theoretically how the system works. As a practical matter, the system is, as far as I can tell, in my many years of research on the subject at this point, the system doesn't work the way it's supposed to. Decisions are not made based on, or not consistently made based on, what's best for citizens or constituents. The decisions are made on politics. And it's interesting to me how our own media, mainstream media, readily acknowledges, as they're talking now, for example, about who's going to be the Republican nominee for president in 2011 and 2012, that whoever, you know, who can raise the most money, you know, that's clearly going to be a critical deciding factor. And yet somehow we pretend that democracy works, that, you know, people are going to make educated and informed decisions based on, you know, their personal views on issues about who's going to make the best president, and that's who they're going to vote for, when the reality is really something much different than that. It's about who gets what information or propaganda or whatever you want to call it out, who has the most money to get the message out the most time in the most effective way to manipulate people psychologically to, you know, vote their way and so forth. So there are, it's an inherently complex question and issue, but currently we have the system that we have. And so the bottom line is, again, if we don't like the laws, then it's up to us to take the steps to use the processes in place to change those laws.
Okay. as I hear what you're telling me regarding the way the system works, I switched the tables around from the earlier question that we had at the beginning of the show, that an individual has the right to change their mind. So if in the past they did vaccinate for one reason or another, then at the present time, their mind and situation and thinking process is in a new place. So they can now have a new belief system that says to them, well, you know, maybe I don't feel like I believe in vaccination for such and such a reason. In the same way, could not a government who lived in a certain time in history, whether it was the technological scientific era, and if they're living in a era where the belief system in the culture says we're going to do everything to utilize the Salk vaccine or the polio vaccine, or we're having an epidemic and this is what we think is going to work, and they try it. And then they have now a system of belief in the government, in the country, or in the state that says this is the way to go. Now we're in a different era where we feel where there are a lot of skeptics. We don't believe that antibiotics is the only answer anymore. So as the collective mind changes their view, it seems as if they should also have a right to change what the law says must be done.
Well, it's an inherently complex topic that we're dealing with here. We have a system of government that has been set up in a particular way that has yielded particular results. But one of the things that was built into our system of government at its founding and inception was the ability for the system to be upgraded. And so, again, if we don't agree with the current, you know, there's sort of two separate questions here in a fundamental sense. What are our rights? What are the boundaries of our rights? That's not always a short answer question, but as a starting point. But once you identify some boundaries and limits on the rights, the question is, are those acceptable? And if they're not, what can you do to change those? And we've had people with a sincere belief that vaccines save the planet from infectious disease and need to be implemented and utilized in a widespread way, or we're all going to suffer serious harm. You know, whether or not and to what extent those beliefs were artificially introduced based on false information and so forth is a separate question. But I certainly don't believe that the vaccine manufacturers or the CEOs in those companies believe that, because they have to know better at this point whether or not they ever believed that. But I think the vast majority of doctors probably really do believe that, and really do think those of us who refuse vaccines are crazy. Although that's a paradigm that's shifting. It has been shifting, and I think it's shifting more and more. We see more and more doctors who, at least quietly, if not openly, do anything from tolerate an opposing view to actually endorse to one degree or another an opposing view. So I think we're shifting. But, you know, the question is, for legal purposes, what are the boundaries? And if we don't like them, what do we do about it? And the answer is the legislative process. But as to whether or not you can refuse vaccines for reasons that are scientific or medical related, on the grounds that, as opposed to having a pre-existing medical condition that would qualify for a medical exemption, that aside from that category, but just that vaccines generally pose a significant risk of harm, or I personally would agree with that, but our law does not yet acknowledge that. And other than the extent to which we have philosophical exemptions, although you don't have to justify philosophical exemptions on the basis of medical, scientific, religious, or any other kind of information or belief, you just have to state in whatever particular way that any state tells you to do that. You just have to indicate that you have, you know, personal beliefs or whatever that object to it. So they don't need to be justified. But to the extent that there are philosophical exemptions, you could say, at least indirectly, there's a way that you can refuse vaccines for general safety and health considerations.
I guess that I can answer my own question with the fact that the laws are flexible and can be flexible, that the purpose of the NVIC and the National Vaccine, tell me what it stands for.
Yeah, the National Vaccine Information Center.
Information Center. And the other organizations where people who have a belief in giving a person the freedom for an exemption or a waiver, people who believe that vaccines might be harmful and there are adverse effects or whatever other potential reasons that they have been instituted, that people do have the ability to change the laws. And that is the main thing, that just as an individual, their personal preferences and beliefs are flexible as they grow with age, so too is the government should be malleable and flexible as the people's beliefs change. And that's what I'm getting at.
Right, right. And as we've become a increasingly larger and more complex society, the mechanisms for change, I think, become harder to actually implement. And so I think our system needs to be more flexible than it is. But, I tell you, I feel like I blinked and the hour has almost disappeared. I thought if I could, Debbie, I wanted to jump into one other question that is such a good question that, you know, who gets to decide or why does the government get to decide, you know, what my beliefs are or how far can they go with that? And because we do have this so-called separation of church and state, and courts are and should be reluctant to get into, in any depth whatsoever, an analysis of people's religious beliefs. But there's a real clear distinction in that arena that I hope will allay at least a little bit of the fears attached with that kind of question, because we do have a very strong state and federal right to our free exercise of religion. And so it kind of amounts to this, that when courts have looked at vaccine exemption, religious exemption claims, and they've been adjudicating these cases to determine whether the exemptions should be denied or upheld, they stay away from actually assessing the beliefs. In other words, courts will not question the validity of a belief itself. A belief doesn't have to be justified. If you believe that
flying spaghetti,
if you get into a realm that raises questions of your mental
sanity,
health, I think you've got a different question altogether. But if you believe that the earth was made in 7 days or 6 days, or you believe the earth really was made in billions of years, the courts cannot say to either one of those people that they are right or wrong. What the courts can do for purposes of a vaccine religious exemption, though, is look at whether the belief is sincerely held. And that's a real hard one to get into unless there's something real obvious, like what we talked about earlier, where a person joined a church for the purpose of getting the vaccine exemption. That's a pretty clear situation in terms of a court being able to reasonably deduce, even if it's ultimately wrong, it's a reasonable conclusion on the part of a court that if you joined it to get the exemption, then it's not really a sincere belief.
Right. That there was an underlying intention before actually taking that action of joining the church, that you had a predetermined reason.
They don't question whether you believe what you say you believe, but what they can question is, are you sincere in that belief? Is that belief a sincere belief, or is it something you concocted one way or another for the purpose of avoiding vaccines for really some other reason?
Mm-hmm.
And there was one case where the parent's testimony at trial was a mixture of assertions about religious beliefs and assertions about fear of adverse events. And the court at the end of the day says, we hear your statements of religious objection, but it's clear to us that your main concern here is the adverse events, and they lost the exemption. So, in other words, the court didn't come right out and say it, but clearly the court in that situation was convinced that the religious assertions was simply a cover-up for a underlying genuine concern about adverse events. Unfortunately, this was a New York case where they didn't have a philosophical exemption. And so, there's a real simple lesson when you say it in hindsight anyway. It's very simple, and it's easy to understand how people would fall into that trap. But in hindsight, it's pretty easy to see that if you're going to argue a religious exemption with something that's not religious, then you're going to run the risk of the court thinking that your claim to religious is either minor, insignificant, or outright disingenuous, and that's what happened in that particular case. Now, that's not a simple cut-and-dried question either, but that's the first layer of it. And so, the courts will not question whether you believe what you believe, say you believe, unless there's some obvious. What they will question, they won't question whether your belief is a belief, but they will potentially question whether it's sincerely held. And they will also potentially question whether it's religious in nature. Let me give you a couple of real quick examples there from the legal precedent. Because when you say, well, who gets to decide and how do they decide, the answer to that is depends on what the law says. If there's when we want to know how a particular law is applied in a particular situation, we look to legal precedent, which gives us points of reference in the law. So it's seldom, if ever, an arbitrary decision on the part of a court, at least if they're doing their job correctly. The court's job is to figure out what the law is and apply it to the particular facts in front of them, not to decide what the judge thinks ought to be the law. Okay? They're human and make mistakes, and then there's surely politics involved from time to time as well, so it's anything but a perfect system. But at least theoretically, the court's job is to figure out what the applicable law is to this set of facts and to apply the law to that set of facts. So there was a court case, federal district court case in New York, where the parents' spiritual religious beliefs stemmed from their prior association with three different tribes of Native American Indians. And at the end of the day, the court found that their beliefs were religious in nature and sincerely held. So you do not have to be a member of an Orthodox religion to have First Amendment protection for your religious beliefs. There was another case, though, that involved a chiropractor. Chiropractors have taken some hits in this arena, where the claim was that the beliefs were religious and they stemmed from his chiropractic philosophy. I think they used a phrase, something like natural order. And at the end of the day, the court said, we know these are sincerely held beliefs, but they aren't really religious in nature. They didn't quite get over that hump from philosophical to religious. And any of these federal court cases, you read the court opinion, they'll be citing cases left and right. They don't just arbitrarily decide what they think it should be. They look at other legal precedent, points of reference in the law, to reason and justify the end result. Now, there's surely
in a way, they're saying that the chiropractor can't make chiropractic a religious system, a religious belief.
That might be one way of kind of summarizing in general terms what happened in the case. But the point is that there is a line somewhere between philosophical and religious, and unless there's a court case out there that says where the line is and why the line should be there based on other legal precedent most of the time, we really don't know where the line is. There are certain areas or questions in law that are unanswered because there isn't yet legal precedent out there. And in those cases in particular, exemptions and waivers are more difficult because instead of asserting, here's what the law is, therefore I have the right, what you in effect have to assert is, here's what a court is likely to say if we have to sue for this right. In other words, you make a legal argument. So situations such as healthcare professionals are sometimes in that situation, or students in college doing healthcare programs that require vaccines because of the hospitals where they have to do clinical work as students.
Our time is up, Alan. We're going to have to continue the question Q&A on the next show. I want to thank everyone for listening. I hope it's been helpful and educational.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Share your life, let your truth